I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Every day, people living in what is called deep poverty face uncertainty about food, about health care, about housing and child care. What is deep poverty? A family of four living on $12,000 a year or less. That's half the U.S. poverty rate. In Philadelphia, a staggering 12% of adults and children live in deep poverty that takes an enormous physical and emotional toll, especially on those children. Philadelphia also has the highest rate of deep poverty of the country's 10 largest cities. Today in this hour of Radio Times, we focus on life in deep poverty and what can be done about it. And we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Angela Sutton is an advocate for mothers raising their children in poverty. She's a member of Witnesses to Hunger. That's a local research and advocacy project partnering mothers and caregivers of young children who have experienced hunger and poverty. And Angela Sutton, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. Also with us is Eva Gladstein, executive director of the Mayor's Office of Community Empowerment and Opportunity for the City of Philadelphia. Eva Gladstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests is Judith Levine, Associate Professor of Sociology at Temple University, wrote a book called Ain't No Trust, How Bosses, Boyfriends, and Bureaucrats Fail Low-Income Mothers and Why It Matters. And Judith Levine, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thanks.
You're welcome. Eva, let me begin with you, and let's begin with Philadelphia. Why the high level of just not just poverty, which the city has, but of this thing called deep poverty? Why Philadelphia?
Well, Philadelphia has the highest level of all poverty, not just deep poverty, of the nation's 10 largest cities. And we think there are a variety of reasons. One is obviously this has occurred over a number of decades. We had an industrial employment base which shrank over many years. And then in terms of recovering from that, we've had a hard time getting people attached to jobs. I think that that's probably one of the fundamental reasons.
Why? Why, though?
Well, I think it may be the types of industries and jobs that are available here, and also the lack of skills and preparation that many people have. And it requires investment from birth going forward to help people have the skills to be able to do that. I would also say, obviously, there are policy reasons at the federal and state and even at the local level that could start to address this. One other point I'd like to make
Sure.
is just that some other of the city of the nation's 10 largest cities have probably gentrified more than Philadelphia and have pushed out more people in poverty. We still have relatively affordable housing rates. So lower income and middle income Philadelphians, you know, and I hope this remains the same and it's something that we look at every day, are still able to live here and afford housing, although it may take up too much of their income.
Let me turn to you, Angela, and you're a mom of two extraordinary young boys. You were telling us about them. They're both students here in the city of Philadelphia. You're a family of three. I don't often ask our guests this, but how much do you live on?
It's about, you could say, $12,000.
$12,000
a year? Yeah. Because I have a side job that only pays minimum wage, and then I get my disability. The problem is the cost of living has went up tremendously over the years, but we don't even have a living wage. Minimum wage has been stunting our growth as a community in whole. So I think that's where my issues are at.
So if you're talking about $12,000 a year, it's about $1,000 a month.
Exactly.
Can you make it through the month?
By the grace of God, yes.
I mean, how do you do that?
Robbing Peter to pay Paul, budgeting. I'm a great budgeter. I could get 50 cents out of a nickel now. I learned some good skills of budgeting because a lot of times what happens is when you have growing children, they're growing, they cost more. You have to worry about food, clothing, rent, electric, gas, sometimes even water, depending on where you're living at. And it's just hard to try to make ends meet because you got to cut certain things and you have no free time, no play money at all. It's just living day-to-day struggles.
Do your boys know that you struggle with money? How aware are they?
They're very aware now because I've been doing a lot of advocacy work and they read a lot. Before I used to keep them sheltered from it. They had no clue. Like we would go to the art museum or something that was free and then I would pack a lunch or something and they wouldn't have no clue that we didn't have any money in our pockets. We just had enough to get to the museum or whatever. But now being as though they're trying to fight as well and they speak up to help other children that are feeling the same things that they're feeling be able to cope. So they're very aware now of the struggle.
I want to get back to both of you, but let me get, Judith, let me get you in on the conversation as well. How do you see deep poverty? And we're talking about people living on half of the poverty rate, which is, I mean, it's hard to live on the poverty rate, but we're talking about half or maybe even less in some instances.
Right. It's remarkably few resources, and it's very difficult, and it becomes a job in itself to survive, I mean, every day to figure out, where's the food coming from? Where are we sleeping tonight? Where are the coats? Winter's coming up. Where are the coats? Where are the boots? Where are the mittens, the hats? And so it's very hard to think about the long term and to get ahead, even for people who are really motivated to do so. And a lot of people are. But your time is taken up with surviving day to day.
Would it be fair to say, if we're talking about deep poverty, that's different from living in poverty, if you know what I mean, in that with poverty, people sometimes move in and out. You might lose a job and then you're poor. You get a job and then you're not poor anymore. Right. With deep poverty, is it something different from that?
Well, I think it's different, although a number of the people in poverty are chronically in poverty also, but people do move in and out based upon a medical problem, loss of a job, or whatever. Deep poverty, it really is about survival, and it's about generation to generation. And so what can you do to kind of stop that cycle, right, in terms of helping the family or helping even the community so there are more resources in the community to help the children.
I mean, is it money? If there were a living wage, Angela talks about a living wage, if people were paid $15 an hour, would that be the end of poverty?
No, that's not enough. People who earn minimum wage are not earning enough. And prices are going up, as Angela said. So even with the minimum wage, there are other kinds of supports that are needed. You know, it has to do with housing costs. It has to do with utility costs. It has to do with having a quality education experience, transportation resources, so that there are a minimum wage would be great. Mm-hmm. It will help people and will move some people out of poverty. But just earning a minimum wage, many of the jobs now are not full-time jobs. So you're earning less than you would expect. And also the scheduling of jobs has changed so that it makes it hard to get childcare, to deal with your child's education. So, you know, a 40-hour-a-week job at minimum wage may help stabilize a family so that they can then begin to move on and think about their career and get some training. But just that in and of itself is probably not enough.
Angela, just a bit about you and your family. You grew up in the Germantown area of Philadelphia?
Yes.
Was your family poor?
Yes. I think we were working class. But we had our times where parents was laid off. And I remember standing in the food stamp line back when they used to give you booklets. And I mean, I remember my mom feeling, I think, more so ashamed that she had to stand there. Because she always worked two jobs at times to make sure ends was met or whatever. And I just remember saying to myself that, oh, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to work. I'm never going to be in this line. I'm never going to have to worry about this. When I have children, I'm going to break this cycle. But unfortunately, it seems like the government is like a bag of crabs in a pan. Like, soon as somebody gets to the top, here they go pulling you down. It's like you can never get ahead. And it's like you want us to get ahead, but yet your actions speak that you don't. And it's a generational curse of lack of education, lack of resources, lack of finances that keeps us going in this poverty circle.
Well, it sounds like, and again, we were talking before going on the air, is that you have two young boys. They're in school in Philadelphia. And it sounds like both you and they are determined to not just, I mean, to get a good education. And I'm assuming all of us would agree that a good education will be something that can break this cycle of poverty.
Yes, because I already instilled in my children that they already have two strikes and they can't afford a third.
What are the two strikes?
Y'all black and y'all men. You're not supposed to survive in the society. You got to fight your way out. Education is everything. The more you know, the more you can fight. You don't want a job. You want a career. You want to be able to always be marketable. You got to get the education that you need so that way you have a fighting chance. That's why, like, my son was upset when I put him in a Chinese charter school. But I told him, you learn a Mandarin and you're African-American, it's going to sell. You're going to always have a job. I promise you. We're 90% into debt to China. I promise you. You're going to have a job, a career. You got to stay focused. And I know it starts at home, but we got to take a time to understand that America is no stronger than its weakest link. And until we understand that and embrace that, I mean, I'm all for helping internationally, but you got to take care of your backyard first. And we're quick to spend money on sport and play. We cleaned up Philadelphia for the Pope. We made sure the streets was clean. Nobody was on the streets. However, what now that he's going, now what? What do we do now? My thing is, I don't like us faking it till we make it. I want us to actually make it.
Mm. What is making it? I'm looking at you, Judith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, making it is being solidly, significantly above the poverty line. The poverty line for a family, people often talk about two adults and two kids, but really many families in poverty are one adult and two kids.
And generally the mom, right?
Generally the mom. Not exclusively, but generally the mom. So the poverty line for a mother or a parent and two kids is $19,000, just over $19,000 a year. If you make $20,000 a year, you're not making it.
Exactly.
That's not enough. So we really need people to get much closer to median income, which is around $50,000 a year.
How do you do that, though?
Well, a lot of what Eva is doing in the city, I think, is very promising. It's these long-term investments. Early childhood education, which is one of, I'm sure Eva will talk about, is one of the city's major approaches, has proven incredibly successful. The Perry Preschool Project, which was sort of the seminal study, shows effects into people's 40s of significantly lower incarceration rates, higher employment rates, higher income, higher education, just from that one preschool experience. And we can, I don't know how much you want to get into the controversy over preschool. There are some people who think effects fade out, and I can talk a lot about that if you're interested. But it's pretty clear it's an effective strategy. So that's an important thing.
Let's take a very short break. I know all three of you want to say more, but we do have to take a very short break. We are talking about something called deep poverty, and Philadelphia has, I guess, for lack of a better word, the dubious distinction of being the city that the largest, top 10 city with the largest amount of poverty and deep poverty. And talking with Eva Gladstein, Judith Levine, and Angela Sutton, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We have three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Let me introduce them, reintroduce them to you. We are talking about deep poverty in Philadelphia. Angela Sutton is an advocate for mothers raising their children in poverty, a member of Witnesses to Hunger. Judith Levine is associate professor of sociology at Temple University, wrote a book called Ain't No Trust, How Bosses, Boyfriends, and Bureaucrats Fail Low-Income Mothers and Why It Matters. Eva Gladstein is executive director of the Mayor's Office of Community Empowerment and Opportunity for the City of Philadelphia. I see a lot of people want to join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us as we carry on this conversation. Eva, can you talk a bit about early childhood education and why that is so important?
Sure. I mean, it's one of, we have both a variety of kind of longer term types of investments that we think the city can use to help people break out of the cycle of poverty, as well as short term things that will just make people's lives easier. But early childhood education has been found to have sort of the greatest effect because children learn most from age 0 to 5. And if they're not prepared to enter school and if there's not a good transition into kindergarten, then they start to fall behind. So they're not reading on grade level and then they're not graduating and then their earning potential is less and they're more likely to get into trouble. So there's a great, you know, for the economists around and for business interests, there's a great return on investment for early childhood education that's high quality. One of the things that we as a city have done is to establish a universal pre-K commission, which has to provide a report in January, a draft report about basically a plan to say how we could establish that in Philadelphia and then have the public and the mayor and city council weigh in on that and hopefully adopt something by the next June.
Judith, you mentioned there's, I guess, some controversy in some quarters about early childhood education. Is that Head Start? Is that what we're talking about? Or is it more than that?
More broadly, Head Start and other programs. Some people question the investment. David Kerp had a great New York Times op-ed on this on Saturday, where he really, I think, argued strongly against the naysayers. There is this issue of whether the effects of preschool fade out over time. And I think there are three important things to keep in mind. Number one, it has to be a good program, and you have to put money into it. So Delaware just had an evaluation that showed high fade out. Well, Delaware puts something like $4,200, something like that, per kid. And Boston, which has much less fade out, puts $10,000 per kid into it. So, you know, not all pre-K is the same. So that's the first thing. The second thing is there is some fade out of the kind of cognitive test scores, but what we call soft skills or non-cognitive skills don't seem to fade out. And those are incredibly important for the labor market. The Nobel Prize winning economist James Heckman is talking about the importance of soft skills like perseverance and love of learning and motivation. And preschool has a huge effect on those things. And then the third thing is a kind of subtle issue, but Public Citizens for Children and Youth has been talking a lot about this issue, that we need to link preschool up better with the rest of schooling. So if the kids just get the same stuff over again in grades K through 3, then of course the kids who didn't go to preschool are going to perform the same on the tests, because the kids who went to preschool we're not capitalizing on that. So, you know, this comes back to the schools and how important it is to fix the schools.
Well, Angela, I mean, it sounds like you have made a personal investment in your son's education.
Yes.
Anything you want to add to that?
Also, just to piggyback on what you're saying, the investment in the schools. Both of my children, I made sure they was reading by the age of 3. They was reading at least on the third grade reading level at the age of 3 because I couldn't get them into a preschool. The thing is, we got to push our children. I mean, invest in them. They get bored when you always repeating stuff that they already know. I'm going through it with my 8-year-old. He wants chemistry and biology at 8. He wants more Mandarin. He said, I can't speak fluent if I get it once a week. He said, where they do this at? Like, he gets very frustrated because being 8 years old, reading on a 12th grade reading level and comprehending at 10th grade reading level is hard in the third grade, you know, especially when other children are teasing you and stuff. Told my why you say, because he was reading a book, short little story. He was reading a book and the class was laughing at him because he said, well, I like to analyze things. I'm very analytical. And the kids were laughing. And he was like, Mom, what was so funny? He was crying that they was teasing him. I said, sometimes you older than you are. No 8-year-old is using the word analytical, baby. I'm sorry. Like, I mean, they are, but they're rare. So just look at it like they don't have the knowledge, so they laugh because of what they don't know. And this is what I mean by investing in the children. Like, how can we expect them to be adults to take over the state if we don't even teach them early on? And you don't want to even invest in them, but you want to invest in stuff that doesn't even help our country grow. I just don't understand it.
This is a personal question, and you don't have to – you can say as much as you want, but I know you've had a hard life. And
yes.
You certainly had a hard childhood, difficulties. You were shot even in your stomach, I think. And
yes.
It was a – sounds like a robbery in a store, and you happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Well, just the wrong – because they were fighting, and I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the gun went off on me at 14. I'm a survivor. I'm not – I don't – I'm victorious over rape. My first incident was at the age of 8. Mm. And then after I got shot, my biological father had raped me. Mm. And because of us living in poverty, I think has a full effect of it. He didn't have no job, no education, so he turned to drugs. And I'm not justifying people that do crimes. What I'm saying is poverty is bigger than just hunger. A lot of people think that because you are hungry, that is the definition of poverty, and it's furthest from the truth. I'm hungry for education. I'm hungry for a career. I'm hungry for a better living. I'm hungry not to be working for minimum wage, and then I have no money for myself at the end of the day. I feel like I work like a slave just to pay everybody else.
But what, I mean, you are clearly determined that your boys are not going to live in poverty. So what happened for you that you said, I'm going to end this?
I had to take responsibility and accountability for my life. I can't keep using society as an excuse or a crutch. So what I did was I took the responsibility to making sure my children have the best education. Like my oldest son, he goes and travels. We live in the greater Northeast. He goes all the way to West Philly, 56 and Marvern, to go to Science Leadership Academy, which is one of the best schools in Philadelphia. Just so he could have a fighting chance. My youngest son gets on a bus 6 o'clock every morning so he could go to a Chinese charter school, Fax Charter School, which is awesome at 10th and Collar Hill. Mm-hmm. They start from kindergarten up to 8th. So, I mean, sometimes there are things out here that do work, but you have to fight a lot of obstacles to get to those things. And it's lack of resources.
I mean, do we make it too hard, Eva, for people to get out of poverty?
It's incredibly hard because it's I think Judith said this, it's more than a full-time job. My entire career, even before I worked with the city, was working with low-income Philadelphians, and they are working harder than other folks, struggling every day, spending more hours, are smarter about, you know, you just having to deal with all these systems that Angela mentioned. It is not easy. If you're running around and, you know, trying to get a child care subsidy so your child can get in child care so that you can work, trying to get food stamps and having the documents get lost and having to get them sent in again. People think folks on TANF are not working. They have to put in 30 hours a week, either in education or training or work, in order to receive a TANF check, which is like
T-A-N-F.
Nothing. T-A-N-F,
yeah.
What used to be called welfare. They're working hard, getting to medical appointments. So this is – it's very stressful also. And there have been studies shown about how the brain actually changes because the amount of stress. So it is hard to overcome all of that. It is a lot of work, and it takes just, again, smarts and perseverance, you know, and hopefully people also have outside supports for that.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that – outside support play, and perhaps it's more sort of under the table, but that's sort of one way to, I guess, to stay afloat. Mm-hmm. To you, Judith, and we did a whole segment on Radio Times before about your book, Ain't No Trust, but you also talk about the importance of just trust in mm-hmm. I guess, addressing some of the needs of people in poverty.
Right. I argue in the book that trust and distrust are really overlooked factors in American society in general, but particularly in poverty. And I interviewed close to 100 mothers, both before and after welfare reform, which was a big policy change in the 90s. And they describe a really deep sense of distrust in lots of different areas of their lives. So just picking up on what Eva was saying, very much so on government and the offices that provide social services, a feeling that the offices are, you know, trying to cheat them, trying to push them away, trying to not offer things that they legitimately are entitled to. And there's a lot of evidence that they're right.
Mm. and not the other way around. People trying to cheat the system?
Right. You know, of course, any system is going to have people who try to take advantage of it. But whenever there are attempts to sort of cut out welfare cheating, they're often the results are embarrassing to government. So, for instance, Florida instituted a drug test for welfare recipients, thinking, you know, we got to get all these, you know, drug abusers off the welfare rolls. And they found 2.6% of cases. And it was so expensive to test everyone to find a few hundred cases that they dropped the program.
Mm. You're nodding your head.
Yes.
Enthusiastically, Angela, go ahead.
Yes, because I feel like, one, you know, with the welfare caseworkers, the lot of, like Judith said, the distrust comes in because you're trying to make a way for your family, but you feel like you're being attacked. Because there's a lot of stereotypes that you're lazy, you don't want to do nothing, you just want to have children, knowing you can't take care of them, you just want to milk the system. And that's furthest from the truth. A lot of times, we just don't want a handout, but then you want to invade privacy, you shame us in front of the children, and then you want to call DHS because we can't do something, and then they're scared that their children are going to be taken from them. And then, you know, it's a lot of stress on the mothers and fathers that have to come, and it's a humbling experience that you have to go in there and ask for help. Then to be talked to like you're beneath somebody, that you are not even a human being, just to get a small little crumbs just to try to make it, and it's not even enough to really make it. But it's so degrading, and it's so a shame that our society feels this way about people as a whole. Everybody should have the access to food. It's a human right to eat. It's a human right to survive. It's a human right to have everything that you need, nutritionist food. You know, it's nobody's being held accountable. Like she was saying, like, there's no trust there because we feel like the government is failing us as a whole. We don't trust you to make sure that we're going to be all right because evidence show that you're not trustworthy, you know. And it's a shame that it's so many people that's in the government that want to help, that want to do right, and it's small few that got so much power and not being held accountable for what they do that it makes the bunch look like bad as a whole as a government.
Eva, you want to add to that?
Well, I guess I want to say that there's a lot of decisions we make at the national and even the state level that affect this. So food stamps get cut, even though there are more and more people who need it, particularly since the recession, just as an example. There's an earned income tax credit, which is great for low-wage families, but if you don't have a job, it doesn't help you. On the other hand, our office has a plan called Shared Prosperity, where we're trying to gather not just city agencies, but there are so many organizations that are trying to work to assist and to, you know, alleviate the lives of, you know, just the conditions that people are living in and to help break the cycle of poverty. And it takes a lot of organization to get people to work together on this stuff. And so there are little things that you can do, but still you're looking at some overwhelming economic situations and, again, largely federal policy. Even at the state, there were cuts associated or new demands in terms of food stamps that made it more difficult for people to get them because you had to have an asset test, just as an example. Now, that's been removed, but and we saw for a while we didn't have Medicaid expansion at the state level. And so those are very large forces that people have to overcome. And at the local level, there are hundreds, if not more, organizations, you know, several of which are represented at this table today, and city agencies that are trying to do their best. But it's hard work, and well, it'll take a while.
And I've heard that argument, which is, I mean, there's so many people working on this issue of poverty, and yet certainly using Philadelphia as an example, and Mayor Nutter is saying, you know, alleviating poverty is one of his top priorities, and yet the city still struggles with this high level of poverty.
It's true. The trend is that the poverty rate is going down, but it's absolutely still a horrific number.
Right.
When we started the work, it was several points higher. But still, again, it more has to do with the economy and federal and state policies. So some of the things that we do are just about just improving conditions. So we try to make sure that we have benefit centers. We try to make sure that people have access to all the benefits they're entitled to and know how to get health care. We have financial empowerment centers. So Angela was talking about understanding how to budget. Right. We help low-income people understand how to improve their credit and reduce debt and save money, you know, to help their children with whatever their dreams might be. So some of this is also just about making it a little bit easier, a little bit more tolerable, until there are more major shifts going on. You know, there's been a cut in funding for adults, for adult literacy and adult education. That's been at the state level. And that, when we talked about helping people attach to jobs, that's really been a detriment.
Let me read an email from Warren. He says, we should remember that minimum wage was never intended to be a living wage. It was just meant to pay a level that stopped total abuse of employees by the employer, never intended to be the head of the household pay scale. You're nodding your head, Judith.
Absolutely. And just to throw a few numbers out here, if you do the math, I think people don't realize this. If you do the math on what you make when you work full-time at minimum wage, it's really staggering. So if you make $7.25 an hour, which is minimum wage, and you work 40 hours a week every week of the year, 52 weeks a year, which almost no one does because low-income people have trouble getting enough hours out of their jobs, as Eva mentioned a while back. But if you do that, you would make $15,080 a year. And again, the poverty line for one parent with two children is $19,000. So you're $4,000 below the poverty line working every single day, every single week. It's not enough.
It's not enough. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I see a lot of people want to join the conversation as well. We're talking about poverty. We're talking about something called deep poverty, which is families living on half of the poverty rate. And Judith Levine describing to us what a minimum wage job does pay. She's associate professor of sociology at Temple University, wrote a book called Ain't No Trust. Angela Sutton is a member of Witnesses to Hunger, and it's an organization here in Philadelphia, partnering mothers and caregivers of young children who have experienced hunger and poverty. And Eva Gladstein, executive director of the Mayor's Office of Community Empowerment and Opportunity for the City of Philadelphia. We've got a lot of callers at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Angela Sutton, Judith Levine, and Eva Gladstein about poverty, deep poverty here in Philadelphia, and what to do about it. Let me get, looks like David from Chester to join us. David, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, I appreciate being on the air.
Sure.
And I don't want to make any judgments, but, you know, I'm almost 60 years old. Since I was a kid, used to drive into Philadelphia and kind of look at the conditions of the city, and we've been talking about this for, you know, 50 years, poverty and poor people and the cities and every city in the country, and nothing has really changed. It's probably getting worse. And I worked for the Housing Authority for about 10 years, and I have a lot of low-income rental properties now. You know, I tried to help poor people, and it was just such a struggle, very few successes. And, you know, after a while, I realized that poverty kind of is a misnomer. I think I've heard around the world that, you know, you're middle class if you can afford more than the subsistence level. So you can afford a phone, you can afford a TV, you can afford a car. So we look at, you know, households in these cities, and there's so many entitlements coming into a household that you talk about 19,000, but when you start adding them up, you know, they may get $1,000 of rental assistance, they may get $500 food stamps, they get utility assistance, child care assistance, and earned income tax credit. And you've got a household of five with $50,000 coming.
Well, David, let me just stop you there because you put some interesting stuff on the table, and I know all of our guests want to respond. I'm starting with Eva Gladstein. Is he right that nothing has changed?
I don't think that's true. There were a lot of people in poverty before, and there are a lot of people in poverty now. I guess one of the changes is there's much less assistance than there used to be. So the waiting lists for public housing or subsidized housing are so long they get cut off. So the percentage of people who would be eligible but can actually get housing assistance is much lower than it used to be, just as one example. Food stamps have been cut. Nobody gets $500 for food stamps. There's no general assistance anymore, so individuals without a family, there's no kind of income safety net. Yes, there's a little bit of assistance for heating bills, but basically people are paying well over what they should have to pay for housing costs, and that squeezes out everything else. It's a rare person who is actually able to get all of the assistance that David mentioned. I wish people were able to get it.
Would it total $50,000?
Yeah, no. And child care subsidy, you are on a waiting list sometimes for months, and you can get kicked off in the middle of the year if your paperwork isn't up to snuff or whatever. So, again, that would be an ideal situation if everybody was able to get all of that assistance that was mentioned. But that's extremely rare, I think.
Angela, you want to add to that?
Yes, Dave. I thank you for calling in, but I need to give you a reality. I'm on Section 8. I'm on disability. I've worked full-time. My last job was at University of Penn. I got laid off because of lack of funding. And I must say, I wish that all that stuff was given to us. I'm not lazy. I work for everything I have ever gotten. Yes, I might have a TV in my house, but guess what? I had to put it on layaway at Walmart, and it took me a year to get it off at $20 a month or something. Just because you see certain things, you don't know the struggle of how they got it. Yes, I have a cell phone. It's with Metro. I had it since 05. My number been the same, and I pay $50 a month. Haven't changed. I can't go to T-Mobile and live the lavish life. I just don't have it. I'm on a tight budget, so my bill will not change. But my phone is nice. I might have to save up for, like, Christmas time. I have to save up and buy stuff when it's cheap. Like, I buy winter clothes in the summer and summertime clothes in the winter. Why? Because it's cheaper. And I make sure my children look nice because I feel like if you look nice and you feel good about yourself, you'll go out there and try to get more. It's such a stereotype that we got it going on. Like, we got this money coming out of nowhere and we living like the poor, richest people in the world. I mean, don't get me wrong. I have crystal eyes, but I got hug juice wallet and I can't get everything I want. But unfortunately, that's the problem in society. They got this stereotype or this persona or this vision of people just got so much going on because of materialistic things, but don't understand that maybe somebody gave that to them or maybe somebody went to the thrift store and found that. I go to consignment shops for my children. I do certain things. You will never know. Because I make sure we fake it till we make it so you can look the part. But unfortunately, we don't have those things. And if you know anybody that's giving that away, can you please give me your number?
Judith, go ahead. It looks like you want to weigh in as well.
Okay. For the rest of the interview, I want to go before Angela because I think she
sorry.
Really
no, –
I'm
sorry
joking.
She stole
I'm
your
joking.
There.
No, I'm just saying you say things so well, it's hard to, you know, come up with things to say after. But a few things. I think that, you know, there is sort of this perception problem that Angela and Eva both talked about. Talking just about TANF, which again is sort of the main, quote, welfare program. Over the time of the recession, unemployment went up 88%, but TANF only went up 16%. And this is this lack of the safety net being there. In 1996, when welfare reform came in, 68% of poor families got TANF. Now only 25% of poor families get TANF. Last number I have is 2013, TANF was 20 cents below its financial level that it was in 1996 in 37 states because it doesn't keep up with inflation. It's not attached to inflation. TANF doesn't bring a family income up to half the poverty line, the deep poverty rate, in any state. So you're still in deep poverty even with TANF. Child care, I hope we'll talk about child care in general. Child care money is is a pittance. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to get someone who
like
will
like a couple hundred a month kind of thing.
It's no week.
A couple hundred a week.
Not. Is it even that much?
Yes. When especially the younger they are, the more expensive.
The cost. You're talking about the cost, but I'm talking about that subsidy.
Oh, okay.
The subsidy is nowhere near the cost.
Nowhere near.
So do you have the figures?
Because it varies according to income.
Right, yes. And also according to child care type. But right. it's dollars a day. I mean, it doesn't cover child care. And then sort of a more general thing that Angela spoke to is I think a lot of people looking on the outside see things, like someone has a TV, someone has nice sneakers, and it is easy. And I understand the frustration, feeling like, oh, we're trying to do all the social policy, and here someone has a big screen TV. But I think if you actually know people in poverty, and this is why it's so important that Angela's doing the work she's doing, you understand some of the thinking. A lot of moms get it. They scrape together to get that TV because it keeps the kids inside. It keeps them off the street. It keeps them from getting from the pull of the gangs. It keeps them from getting involved in drugs. It keeps them where they are safe. It means kids are not running around having, you know, free time because their moms don't feel it's safe. And that TV is keeping them where the moms can watch them.
Eva, it looks like you had something.
And the
as
cell
well.
Phone is incredibly important if you want to work. And it's usually for many people also their sole way into the internet and access because they don't have broadband at home. So think about that as a cell phone, as a tool for working, as are the cars. You know, very many people are you know, using three buses and spending an hour and a half trying to get to a job in the suburbs or something like that. And a car actually makes work much more viable for some families until we get enough jobs that work in Philadelphia. People are having to commute.
Is that, and we have about 10 minutes before we have to end this discussion, but is that the issue, which is creating more jobs in the city and jobs that pay more than the $7.25 an hour? Is that the goal?
I don't think it's only jobs. It's also helping people prepare so they can get the jobs. And we have some fine programs now around that help people prepare for jobs. But very often people have more barriers. Either English is not their first language, they have low literacy, they might have health issues, things that prevent them even from getting into the job training program. So in addition to more jobs, it's just helping people prepare for those jobs. And there has been a shift actually in federal policy, which makes me hope that this will improve a little bit. There's new federal law that says that the dollars that our city gets for workforce have to be targeted to the people who have the greatest needs.
Let me get, looks like Joshua from Downingtown, I believe. Joshua, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks so much for taking my call. I love the discussion. I think it's extremely relevant for our time. And real quickly, I had a couple of points I wanted to make. Is there a wage disparity in Philadelphia especially that makes it a better candidate for this deep poverty that we're discussing? What I mean is there a generational sense of racism in Philadelphia that may play a part between whites and blacks getting a different pay raise, different pay cut, between men and women, between immigrants versus born-bred Americans? Are there any kind of real-world numbers to back up that maybe there is some kind of disparity between these people beyond just what they can personally overcome that may be keeping them from climbing higher? I'll take my answer off the air.
Joshua, thanks for the call. Eva, I'm back at you only because of your job here in the city.
Right.
Is there?
Well, I would say that we have more people living in communities of poverty. And so when you grow up in a community of poverty, it hurts your chances. I don't think it's necessarily a wage differential, but you have fewer opportunities. The schools may not be as good. Mm-hmm. You might not have the connections and the social networks to jobs. So I think that that is an issue in the city of Philadelphia, that there are communities of deep poverty that have been that way. And we are also a segregated city. So that compounds the issue. In terms of raising wages, we're dependent upon the state. And actually, the current governor has proposed an increased minimum wage. Mm-hmm. We'll see if he's successful with that or not. But I don't think it's It's simply a matter of an employer and an employer by employer basis paying some people more than others. I think it's more about what kind of opportunities people have to get to those better jobs.
I know a little bit about you, Angela, in that you're on Section 8 housing, but one of your goals was to get out of whatever neighborhood you were in before to go to a neighborhood that felt safer for you and your family.
Yes, because when they gave us the Section 8 voucher, first of all, I was thankful for Senator Casey and his hard work and his whole entourage of workers, because I had spoke one day and I had a slumlord, and he was like, well, why are you living there? And his wife is the one that came up to me and said, well, we have to do something about this. You're fighting up here, but you're living this way. And I was on a waiting list, I think, from like 98 or something. And
how many years were you on the waiting list?
Because it was like 2008 or something when I got it.
Oh, 10 years.
Like, 10 years.
Yeah, so easy 10 years. And when I got it, they gave me a list, but it was all the slums, like the hood, the ghetto, where, just impoverished, like it was just sad. And I was just like, I wasn't going to accept that. I didn't accept it. I went looking and I kept looking until I found somewhere where there's not dirt on the street, where there's no gunshots out my window, where the cost of living is a little high for my income, but I just was hopeful that I wouldn't be on it for long. And when they accepted it, I was shocked because they don't accept a lot of Section 8 vouchers. But when he interviewed me, he said, okay, you seem like a good candidate. And he mm-hmm. gave me a chance. A lot of times the people that's impoverished and in poverty, is the fact that we don't have the documentation to state that I'm 45 credits away from a bachelor's. A lot of times, because I owe all this money to Drexel, I can't even get back to school, which is only a year and a half. And with like bothers me is the fact that a piece of document is stopping me from a career that I can do better than some people because I have the experience of hunger and poverty. I experience gun violence. I experience. So if I go for a job in behavioral health with youth, I qualify just by my experiences. But because I don't have documentation, you don't want to give it to me. So in saying that, with what you're saying, yes, it's all about where you live, who you know sometimes, who you connected to. And like I said, poverty is a big, big thing with hunger and lack of education, lack of housing. It's such a bad circle that needs to be addressed as a whole.
And we're almost out of time here. And Judith, I'm probably going to be giving you the last word here.
Oh, I just wanted to say in answer to the caller that I do think he is hitting on something important. And there are real racial and gender differences in the labor market. And sociological research has shown that lots of people get jobs through networks. So if your network doesn't include people who are placed in good jobs, then you're not going to have access. And there is a difference there by race. And also that audit studies have shown that people are steered to different jobs based on their race and ethnicity.
Eva, again, we're almost out of time here, about 40 seconds. I mean, going forward, do you have some optimism that Philly can continue this incremental address or focus on poverty?
I do. And again, I think there are some opportunities. We have a plan now with a lot of partners called Shared Prosperity Philadelphia. We have an early learning plan called A Running Start. I think there's a lot of focus around high quality early learning and helping improve early learning and the Universal Pre-K Commission. And I think hopefully federal policy around workforce development will help adults also attach to jobs. I think we also have to keep pounding the state to improve the policies at that level, because they really affect us as well.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. And thank you, all three of you, for joining us today in Radio Times. Eva Gladstein, Executive Director of the Mayor's Office of Community Empowerment and Opportunity for the City of Philadelphia. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Also with us, Angela Sutton, and she's a member of Witnesses to Hunger. And Angela, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests, Judith Levine, Associate Professor of Sociology at Temple University, author of a book called Ain't No Trust, How Bosses, Boyfriends, and Bureaucrats Fail Low-Income Mothers and Why It Matters. Judith Levine, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in the first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you.